This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Millions of refugees have fled Syria in the past 3.5 years. About 24 have come to South Florida since January. If Governor Rick Scott and a majority of the U.S. House of Representatives have their way, those would be the last to come here without stepped-up screening. The focus on refugees and state and national security this week follow last week's terrorist attacks in Paris. Now, the governor was among more than a dozen governors in the U.S. writing letters to Congress saying they didn't want Syrian refugees to be sent to their states for resettlement. Here's Governor Scott this week on CNN.
We're a state of tourism. We'll have over 100 million tourists. We're a state of immigration. We have over 250 languages spoken in our state. We love people coming to our state. But we don't want one terrorist. We know that one of the terrorists in France was posed as a Syrian refugee. We don't want any of those in Florida. When something like this happens, why wouldn't you stop, say, what happened in France? What can we learn from that? What was it? What were their security measures? Are ours different? So we make sure it doesn't happen in America. And I'm responsible. Vic, I'm responsible for everybody in my state. I don't want anything to happen to my state.
Now, before Governor Scott sent his letter earlier this week, South Florida Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo told WLRN he was guarded about accepting any more Syrian refugees here.
As long as the screening process is robust and rigorous, we cannot take any chances now that we've seen what happened in Paris.
On Thursday, Curbelo was among the 289 U.S. representatives to vote for more strict screening measures for refugees, specifically from Syria and Iraq. He was joined by South Florida Republican Representatives Mario Diaz-Balart and Ileana Ross-Layton. Meantime, a separate migrant crisis has been building on the border in Central America between Costa Rica and Nicaragua. Thousands of Cubans have been stopped by Nicaragua in their effort to come to the United States. So what are the similarities and differences in these refugee crisis situations? How are the two treated by the United States? Have you been personally affected? Have you helped someone escaping violence or oppression coming to South Florida to build a new life? Maybe you have a family member or a friend in Costa Rica or in Syria, for that matter, hoping to come here. We will start with national security and refugees in South Florida. Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. You can also tweet us at WLRN is our Twitter handle, and find us on Facebook, facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Mimi Whitefield does the same for our partner, the Miami Herald. And Tim Rogers is Fusion Senior Editor for Latin America. All three of you, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Tim Padgett, what did Governor Scott ask for from the new Speaker of the U.S. House, Speaker Paul Ryan?
Well, essentially to cut off funding for resettlement of any refugees, really, in the United States in the wake of what happened in Paris, based on the argument, as you just heard in the clip, that one of those terrorists had come into the European Union as a Syrian refugee. Now, many would claim that you know, there's a big difference between what happened in that circumstance and what would happen in the United States. Mm-hmm. The terrorist who came in as a Syrian refugee was coming through Greece, which is just being overwhelmed. This is a foundering government in Greece that's being overwhelmed by Syrian refugees. Whereas in the United States, you've got a much more rigorous process I think we've had 785,000 refugees admitted into the U.S. since 9/11, and only three of those have been involved in any kind of what you could call terrorist activity.
There's also questions. The governor in his letter used this 425 figure, saying that there's a request by the federal government to send 425 Syrian refugees to Florida. After the letter was released, Tim Padgett, there were some questions that, in fact, there's not 425 requests for Syrian refugees. There's 425 slots for refugees from around the world to potentially be sent to Florida.
And this is where the sort of political factor in all of this becomes a little more transparent, because the key word there really isn't so much Syrian refugees, it's just refugees. Mm. I think we're in an election cycle now, and conservatives are really jumping on this issue of, you know, just the idea that any refugee really coming into the United States could present this terrorist potential.
Is a security risk. Mimi Whitefield from our partner in the Miami Herald, what can any governor do regarding refugees? Is there much gubernatorial stature here?
No, there's really nothing that the governor can do to prevent refugees from resettling in the state. He can, as he did, appeal to Congress on security concerns. It's a little bit ironic that he is so opposed to the Syrian refugees, because what we do have going on in this state is kind of a slow-motion Marielle with Cubans taking advantage of the Cuban Adjustment Act, tens and thousands of Cubans every year to arrive in South Florida, get green cards, and become permanent residents.
Now, there actually is one thing that a governor can do, and we just saw it done this week by the governor of my home state, Indiana. Mike Pence. There's a very strong relationship between the state governments and non-governmental organizations that do the actual work of resettling refugees. If a state government decides it's not going to give that kind of financial and logistical cooperation to those agencies, then you can cut off, you know, the resettlement. Yeah. And for example, in the Indiana case, they were resettled in Connecticut.
Yeah, in this non-governmental organization, in this case, it's usually the United Nations, directed through the United Nations. Tim Rogers, the Latin American senior editor with Fusion, let me bring you in here, because we have seen governors take action on the immigration stance here in the United States, most famously, perhaps, and most controversial, the Arizona immigration law, which went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court essentially upheld a portion of that law that allows Arizona law enforcement to inquire as to a person's legal immigration status if they're arrested or a suspect in any kind. So there is immigration and, you know, state law that can be intersected here.
Yeah, I mean, just I think to give echo to what Mimi and Tim are saying, that, you know, the governors and state governments can't override federal policy, federal decisions on immigration policy and refugee resettlement, but they can be uncooperative partners in refugee resettlement. They can be obstructionists. They can be deadbeats that make it difficult for folks who are in that process to resettle, to access the services that they need. And they can also be openly hostile, as we see in Arizona, where they can implement policy that critics say is nothing short of racial profiling and harassment. So the short answer is no, they can't block people, but they can be recalcitrant, and I think that that's something the federal government needs to take into consideration when they're deciding where to relocate refugees.
The White House has already threatened to veto this bill that came out of the U.S. House of Representatives yesterday that puts in these new, more stringent screening standards specifically for refugees from Syria and Iraq. But we know it's not a direct path from Syria to South Florida. Rahma Salah arrived here in Miami with her family back in August, and this is a process that took her 2 years. She first went to Turkey from Aleppo, Syria. It was there that she learned then her family would be coming to Miami.
I was very, very happy. I told my mom I wish it to be America. I love English. I love English language. I think in future what will be I will be happy to will be better in the future. I will be a doctor, and my sisters, it will be a lawyer. They love study too much.
We've seen reaction on social media here. Peter Cook writing on our Facebook page, once you immigrate, you can move to whatever state you want. Andrew Green writing on our Facebook page, sorry, folks, it is the responsibility of our governor to protect the people of this state. Complain, that is our right, continues Andrew, but let the guy do his job. Matthew added, yes, we should help the innocent, but we have to be cautious and sensible. Mimi Whitefield from our partner, the Miami Herald, you mentioned the irony between the rhetoric regarding Syrian and Iraqi refugees this week and the generation and a half treatment of Cuban refugees. This is happening, of course, all at a time when another Cuban crisis has been building on the border between Costa Rica and Nicaragua. What's happening there?
Well, there are currently more than 2,000 Cubans stuck in Costa Rica on the border with Nicaragua. They tried to cross into Nicaragua on their journey north. Their ultimate goal is the Texas border and to be admitted into the United States. But the Nicaraguan government on Sunday turned them back, so they are all congregated in Costa Rica, waiting for some kind of word when they can move on. Costa Rica has been, Costa Ricans are helping them with food and shelter. There's some temporary shelters set up. On Tuesday, the foreign ministers of the countries that are in the path of the Cubans' quest to reach the United States are meeting to discuss what to do about this crisis. However, they've said that most of their talk will center on humanitarian issues rather than security.
Yeah, there's been talk about creating a humanitarian corridor through this section of Central America. Tim Rogers with Fusion, you've been on the southern border of Nicaragua. What are the conditions like for these Cuban refugees or migrants?
Yeah, I was there earlier this week, and I think I described it in the article I wrote for Fusion as it looks like a tent city without tents. There are people sprawled on cardboard all over the place, competing for shade underneath trees and limited awning space. It's very hot there during the day, and at night it's torrential rain showers. There's only a few public faucets that are available to people where they're washing their clothes and hanging them on the fence during the day and essentially bathing in their underwear in public. So there's no privacy. There's very limited facilities when it comes to bathrooms. In appearance, it looks a lot like the refugee situation that I saw among the Syrians in Europe. I was on the Austrian border covering the Syrian refugees when they crossed over from Hungary.
Just a matter of 6 weeks or so ago.
In September, correct. And it looks very similar. It was whole families in tow. People that had all their earthly belongings in a knapsack hanging on their shoulder. And it was a lot of educated people, professional people who had left jobs in their home country.
This is what you encountered in Costa Rica on the Nicaraguan border.
Both the Syrians and the Cubans. And in the case of the Syrians, they had lost their homes to war, but the Cubans had sold their homes. So there's no going back for either.
Tim Padgett, the scenes that Tim Rogers describes on the border in Eastern Europe and the border in Central America, the location of those refugees may have been from different places. The scenes may be the same. But what those refugees could encounter in the United States is significantly different.
Exactly.
In terms of right. The welcome mat.
You've got this rush of Cubans coming through now because of there's a certain level of panic involved because they're worried that the so-called wet foot, dry foot policy may be ending, the policy that allows Cuban immigrants here in the United States to gain a fast track to legal residence. They're worried that that could be ending because the U.S. and Cuba are normalizing relations. So that's why you're seeing this flood now coming over land. Well over 30,000, we believe now, this year have come into the United States through that overland corridor, compared to fewer than 10,000 by sea. So that's really what's pushing this. And again, if the Syrian refugee debate here is about conservative politics, what's going on in Central America is about left-wing politics. Really at play here is that Daniel Ortega, the president of Nicaragua, is a very staunch ally of the communist Cuban government in Havana. And that government in Havana wants to push the issue of getting rid of wet foot, dry foot. And Nicaragua, in a sense, is sort of doing Cuba's bidding by blocking these Cuban immigrants to make wet foot, dry foot an issue.
Geopolitics playing out here, not only in South Florida, but perhaps in your home. Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup, 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576, on Twitter, at WLRN. Look for our Facebook group as well. Mimi, you alluded to the irony here between the immigration treatment and the rhetoric between refugees from Syria and Iraq and, of course, the migrants that this community has seen come from Cuba for the better part of a half century. And considering the history of Cuban migration to the U.S., specifically South Florida, and a past history that has included violent bombings carried out by Cubans here, is this resistant to Syrian refugees just a double standard again?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a double standard. There, the Cuban refugees gathered in Central America, basically, the route for them is to travel from Cuba, anywhere in Central America that's within striking distance of the United States, or to go to a country where they do not need a visa, and then make their way north. And what helps them along in this quest is the Cuban Adjustment Act, which is a special treatment for Cubans. Basically, a Cuban arriving at the U.S. border in Texas without a visa can present themselves, say they want to avail themselves of the Cuban Adjustment Act, be paroled into the United States, mm-hmm. and after a year and a day, they can ask for permanent residency. Their green cards get certain benefits, and there is actually very little screening for these people.
We saw this week when the U.S. House of Representatives bill came to a vote that would require more stringent screening for Syrian and Iraqi refugees. We saw three members of the South Florida Dade delegation that have some significant connections to the Cuban American community, Representatives Curbelo, Mario Diaz-Balart, and Ileana Ross-Layton, all vote in favor of more strict screening for Syrian and Iraqi refugees. Tim Padgett.
Yeah, and this is, again, this is putting the Cuban Adjustment Act, or the slang wet foot, dry foot, under a hotter spotlight. And it's making that double standard just so much more apparent to people. And I really think that, ironically, the whole Syrian refugee crisis is one of the things that's going to eventually help do away with the Cuban Adjustment Act, because that double standard is just so glaring.
And Tim Rogers with Fusion, we've seen this double standard at play here in South Florida played out, especially with the Haitian community. Marlene from North Miami Beach sent us this comment as a member of our Public Insight Network. As a group that has suffered systemic discrimination as a result of unfair immigration policies, the Haitian American community empathizes with the Syrian refugees. This is a situation we're familiar with here in South Florida. It's a situation that continues now to get some national security focus on the national stage, don't you think?
I think there's a question of empathy here. A lot of different Latino groups of different nationalities look somewhat enviously at the wet foot, dry foot policy. For Cubans, the United States, the Texas border is a finish line. It's a happy place. For Mexicans trying to cross the United States, it's a place of apprehension. Same for Central Americans. And so there is a lot of resentment. But I think people are starting to see that the Cubans are going through a lot of the same ordeals as other Central Americans and Latino immigrants, with the only difference being that there's a finish line for them in sight.
We are on the Florida Roundup here. Join us, won't you? 800-743-9576. 800-743-9576. Immigration status in the United States back on the forefront with the Paris terrorist attacks just 1 week ago, as that debate continues throughout the nation and here certainly in South Florida. Let's go up to West Palm Beach where Bill joins the conversation. Bill, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Thank you. I have lived in Florida for 37 years, and starting out in Key West, I lived there during the Mariel boat lift, and I think it's well beyond time to end the wet foot, dry foot policy. Senator Rubio is all in favor of that, and yet he once has this radical idea about Syrians. We have no idea if there are radicalized Cubans that are trying to come over, and once they step foot, there's no vetting process whatsoever. We just let them in. So this, to me, is just such hypocrisy, and it's an anachronism that needs to be changed.
Bill, we got it from West Palm. You've traveled throughout South Florida there from Key West all the way up to West Palm. Thanks for joining us. Tim Padgett, to Bill's point, we have seen the result of the open door policy, essentially, to Cubans. We back in the 70s and 80s here in Miami, we had, hotel bombings on Collins Avenue. We had consulate violence that was allegedly perpetrated by Cubans here trying to do harm to the dissident group in South Florida.
Well, Cubans themselves back in that time were very wary of a lot of the elements that were coming in on the Mariel boat lift. Fidel Castro essentially opened up the prison doors in Cuba for the Mariel boat lift, and let's not forget the movie Scarface, for example.
Right.
That script was based on that particular problem. So yeah, I mean, just as the caller just mentioned, I mean, this idea that we should make it's so much more stringent for every other population in the world except Cubans. I mean, it's just really lost its currency by now.
Let's go back to the phones. Maria is joining us from Miami. Maria, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi. I was listening to your program. I'm a Cuban-American. 53 years ago this week, my mom came from Cuba at the age of 12 by herself. My grandmother put her on a plane with her bags to save her life from a totally different environment. And I've been listening to the show. We've been talking about it with my family. And I feel like the refugees at the border have even stated to the media that they are leaving because of the economic situation in Cuba. Mm-hmm. That cannot be compared to every other refugee that wants to enter this country. My husband came from Colombia. He had to go through the same process that every other refugee does to enter this country with a visa, and then the same steps to get a residency and citizenship, which he has now. So there definitely needs to be an amendment and change to the wet foot, dry foot.
And what kind of change would you support, Maria, as a Cuban-American yourself?
As a Cuban-American, when my mom came, she came knowing that she could not go back to Cuba. Many of these people come, and a year and a day later, they're traveling back to the country. They're taking everything back, to the money, things, and it's just back and forth and back and forth. If you're fleeing persecution, you're not going back. My parents haven't been back.
In your mind, does it matter if it's economic persecution, opportunity persecution, or the threat of or reality of physical violence like we've seen in Syria?
For me, it is physical violence. My paternal grandparents left, first started with economic persecution, which then, as things progressed in Cuba, became violent.
Yeah. Maria, well, 53 years on, congratulations, I suppose. Thanks for joining us here on the Roundup. Let's continue in Miami. Fernando joins the program now. Fernando, go ahead.
Hi. I would like to make 2 points. Number one is that most Cuban-Americans now really feel that the wet foot, dry foot policy has outlived its usefulness, and that this was in place when Cubans were coming for as political refugees and not like economic migrants like they're coming now. And second, I would like to make a point that I think it's disingenuous to talk about the same problems that a Syrian migration with the terrorism that's going on now with the ISIS and Paris and everything else, mm-hmm. with the bombs that occurred here 40 years ago, which have not occurred for many, many times and for many, many years. And I think that there is nothing that has the same equivalent to talk about one policy with the other.
Fernando, we appreciate you adding your comments there. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Mimi Whitefield, let me ask you, as the foreign ministers of these Central American countries involved in this dispute about whether or not to allow Cuban migrants continue through this route next week, what are the potential outcomes of this, and what options do the Cubans on the border of Nicaragua and Costa Rica have at this point?
Well, before I answer that question, Tom, I think this is a good time to point out another special feature of the Cuban Adjustment Act. 3 years ago, Cuba changed its migration laws. It used to be if you left Cuba and you were outside the country for 11 months, you would lose the benefit of your Cuban citizenship. Under their new law, you can be outside the country for 2 years without losing any benefits. So this basically sets up the scenario where people who come to the United States to mm-hmm. take advantage of the Cuban Adjustment Act can come and go, as some of the callers have mentioned, very, very freely. And some are just visiting family, but among the others who have availed themselves of this are Medicaid scammers, people sure. who have run afoul of U.S. law.
Insurance fraud. The Sun Sentinel has done some great investigative work in that. I mean, it's a great reminder, Mimi, that obviously it takes two countries to have an immigration relationship and an immigration policy, even if those policies are at conflict of one another. And it does lead to, obviously, what we've seen just developing this week in the last couple of weeks on the border of Nicaragua and Costa Rica.
Now, in terms of what's going on there, one of the ideas that has been advanced by the foreign minister of Costa Rica is setting up a humanitarian corridor where some of these Cubans could make their way to the United States, where they wouldn't be victimized by people smugglers. The State Department released a rather interesting statement this week in which they said that it is the sovereign right of a country to return people who do not have the proper documentation. So it is possible that some of these countries in Central America could choose to return the Cubans.
Tim Rogers, if you head back to this area next week, next month, what do you anticipate to encounter? More Cubans piling up on this border, or perhaps maybe a release valve that could be created?
I think the situation right now is that the faucet is still open, and Nicaragua is twisting the hose at the border. So it's not clear how long that can remain sustainable. Already, it's not sustainable. I was in the Panamanian jungle on the border of Colombia too, and there were 700 Cubans in this small town I was in there too, and authorities there told me that there were 3,000 people passing through each month. So
coming.
All those people are still on their way.
If there's a release valve that's created here on this border with Costa Rica and Nicaragua for these Cubans to continue on, is that potentially just the first choke point of other border choke points that could be manufactured or created?
I don't believe so, because again, I don't. When you get farther north in Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, you don't have that same political factor. Again, what is driving this to this politically to a large extent is that the Cubans, let's face it, are fairly embarrassed by seeing so many Cubans leaving the island.
The Castro regime,
because of the economic situation. What they're hoping for is that if they can pressure the U.S. government to get rid of the Cuban Adjustment Act and wet foot, dry foot, that will mean fewer Cubans then wanting to leave the island to go to the United States. It's a sort of a bet on their part, but that's the gambit here.
Two Tims and a Mimi on Latin America relations here on the Florida Roundup. That was Tim Padgett covering the Americas for us here at WLRN, covering Latin America, senior editor at Fusion. Tim Rogers with us. Thank you, Tim Rogers. You can follow Mimi Whitefield, who covers Latin America for our partner, the Miami Herald. She's on Twitter at Herald Mimi. Tim Padgett at Tim Padgett Digit 2. We got plenty more to come here on the Florida Roundup. Stick around. There have been more than a half dozen police-involved shootings this week in South Florida. Why? That's next on the program. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
Heads up, he just pulled out a gun. He's got a gun in his hand. Units, on the other side, see some cover.
This was the Miami-Dade police officer on Tuesday this week chasing a man who was suspected of robbing a Wendy's restaurant near Cutler Bay in South Dade. The man was on foot and eventually shot and killed by cops. He was just one of seven people shot by South Florida police in the past week. Two people died. Each case certainly is separate and has its own circumstances that remain under investigation. The shootings, though, come as the national scrutiny and debate over police tactics continue. How rare are these kinds of shootings? Seven in a week in one county, and they come as new state data indicate a drop in crime rate across South Florida. So what's your experience with law enforcement? Share it with us here at the Florida Roundup. What's your community's relationship with cops, and how does your neighborhood treat police officers? That phone number here to join in, 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Social media, of course, on Twitter at WLRN and facebook.com/group/TheFloridaRoundup. Kate Jacobson joins us, a police reporter with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Kate, welcome to the program. Nice to see you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Chuck Rabin covering cops and crime for our partner, the Miami Herald, with us from the Miami Herald WLRN studios in Doral. Chuck, let's start with these shootings in Miami-Dade County. Any common characteristics with these seven shootings this week?
Not really all that many. It's just a very unusual cluster.
It's a significant cluster, though. I mean, seven in, what, 96 hours?
Seven in about 6 days.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, as I mentioned, they all have their own circumstances here. But how rare is it for this volume of police-involved shootings to happen in such a relatively short period of time for Miami-Dade County?
It doesn't happen often. Every few years, you'll see clusters. the numbers still generally come out to, you know, similar to what they were in the past. About 4 or 5 years ago, they were having gang problems up in the north, and there was a cluster similar to this. So it just happens. The numbers overall aren't that much significantly higher than they have been in the past.
It just seems the concentration of it this week is certainly what has grabbed some attention.
It was very rapid fire.
Yeah. Two Opa-locka cops shooting a man Wednesday after he jumped on their patrol car and smashed a window. One man shot and killed after robbing that Wendy's restaurant near Cutler Bay, as we mentioned. That was in broad daylight. He was on foot. Miami-Dade officer shooting three teenagers Friday night in South Dade County. Another county officer shooting a 16-year-old in Northwest Dade County after responding to a carjacking and a couple of robberies. And then in South Miami, a police there shooting a man after he was pulled over at a gas station, and cops say he disobeyed orders and made a threatening move. Several of these happened with the suspects in vehicles. What's the engagement rule when the suspects are inside of a car or a truck?
One of the interesting things about these shootings is, if you start to look at them closely, and we're trying to do this now, it shows you how the different policies in the different departments affect the way police react, and shows you the cause and effect and what happens. The shooting into the vehicle, the county has a different policy than the city and Miami Beach police, who, unless they see a visible weapon, are no longer permitted to shoot into a moving vehicle. And in Miami, no cop's been injured or a person's been shot in decades inside a moving vehicle.
Let me dig into that a little bit further here. You're saying in Miami Beach, the police engagement is that Miami Beach police officers cannot shoot at a moving vehicle if there's no weapon that is spotted. Is that right?
That's correct. It came
and
about...
is that a consequence of that Memorial Day shooting?
That had a lot to do with it. They also, they went before a police executive committee, and they studied the city and the police officers in different departments, and it was one of the recommendations that they made.
And moving vehicle, is that a key phrase? What if the vehicle's, if the suspect's in the vehicle, but the vehicle's not moving?
Well, if the difference is that the county looks at it as if the vehicle is a deadly weapon. Their argument is that, you know, if an officer's trapped, he's going to use all the necessary lethal force possible to save his life or to save anybody else who might be in danger.
And back to that county rule of engagement here with a suspect in a vehicle, as you mentioned, the vehicle could certainly be used as a weapon. Nobody's going to argue that. The threshold for the police officer in the county to fire into a vehicle is fear for their safety or life or the life of another. Is that about right?
That's accurate. But if you speak to people who have made the change, I just spoke to some folks in Miami. They made that change 2 decades ago or longer, and there hasn't been an officer injured or a person shot in the car that they can remember going back to almost Lozano, I think, in 99.
Really? Yeah. And this week we had, what, three teenagers shot in one vehicle?
That was the Friday. That was the first shooting that
right.
started this spate. There were actually five people in a car,
yep.
in a truck that the officer noticed had been stolen. It was a police vehicle. He chased it briefly, it crashed, and as he went on foot to approach it, he claims that the car accelerated towards him and he fired into the car. He struck three people.
Chuck Rabin with the Miami Herald, stick with us here. I want to bring in Kate Jacobson, cops reporter for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Kate, you've been digging through the state crime statistics that were released this week from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. What did it show about the crime rate in the first 6 months of this year?
Well, the first 6 months, the crime rate in general has dropped statewide, and that's true also in Miami-Dade, Palm Beach, and Broward counties. But forcible rape is up, and domestic violence statewide. Domestic violence crimes, which include murder, forcible rape, aggravated assault when it includes a domestic relationship, those rates have increased slightly.
What kind of, you mentioned rape, you mentioned domestic violence, what kind of crimes are included in this net of crime statistics from the FDLE?
The FDLE includes basically two types of crimes, forcible crimes, violent crimes, and then nonviolent crimes. So that's murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, larceny, and motor vehicle theft.
So those are the crimes that are involved in this. And it said the crime rate was down in Florida in the first 6 months of the year, as well as in the three big counties here making up South Florida.
Right. It dropped about 2.2% in the state in general. Mm-hmm. Miami-Dade had about a 5% drop. Mm-hmm. Broward had a 3% drop, and Palm Beach County had a 2% drop.
So Palm Beach was even with the state. The other two dropped
a little bit
faster
more
than the state was dropping.
And those are just compared to this time last year. So this isn't like totally, you know, this year in general compared to all of last year. This is from January and June of 2014 to January and June of 2015.
Chuck Rabin, you've been covering cops and crime for a good long time. It's only a six-month sampling. It's only year over year. What do you read into it, though?
I think it seems to be, and Kate seems to have studied it more than I did recently, but it seems to be a continuing trend. As far as the numbers that she said were up, those are probably the toughest crimes for, you know, cops to get ahead of. I mean, how do you get inside someone's home, or, you know, when things are happening like that?
Yeah.
So whatever the reasons may be, you know, crime, you know, it we see it on TV all the time. It's a 24/7 thing, and it scares people, but the numbers don't really portray the fear that everybody's got out there.
Right. Actually, I spoke to a professor up at Florida State University who said the same thing. He was like, we've seen in the last 30 years, and he studied this data. That's one of the areas that he specializes in. And he said, you know, we're safer than we've ever been. But the consumption of news and the perception is super duper high. And that has a lot to do with how aware we are of crime that's around us, the training of law enforcement. But there's no one thing that you can peg to these crime rates going down. He did say with rape, we might see more of an increase now because that's a crime that's gotten a lot of attention, where in the past even 5 years, we've encouraged people to come forward and report those. So we're going to see probably more an uptick in rape arrests and charges because people are more comfortable reporting their sexual assault and rapes, and because law enforcement agencies take it a little more seriously now than they probably did 10 years ago.
We're talking about crime in the community here in South Florida. Join the conversation. Talk about your relationship with law enforcement. Have you experienced maybe a lower incidence of crime in your neighborhood? Does it feel safer where you live and where you work? 800-743-9576 here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. 800-743-9576 on Twitter at WLRN, and of course on Facebook as well. Kate, we talked about the counties and how they've seen crime rates drop at the same pace as the state or even faster. What about communities within the counties?
Right. We've seen generally, I know that the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, which covers a lot of Palm Beach County, the Miami-Dade Police Department, and the Broward Sheriff's Office, they've all seen decreases in general crime as well as rape, which is interesting because a lot of the smaller cities have seen higher.
Right. So, so the county law enforcement organizations have seen lower rates of forcible sexual offense, aka rape, but yet the overall rate of rape has increased. So that means it's being reported in municipalities with their own forces.
Typically, I mean, Fort Lauderdale had and you have to take these numbers with kind of a grain of salt because year to year, these, you know, you might see changes. It's more important to study long term data, but from this time this year compared to last, there were about 30 more rapes in Fort Lauderdale than there were. We've seen, you know, rape rising in places like Boca Raton. You know, Boynton Beach saw about the same amount of rape. West Palm Beach saw more. So, I mean, and these numbers are not like, you know, 100 more rapes. They're pretty small, but...
Right. But they are an increase,
they're
though.
They're increases.
I actually think you hit on something a little while ago, Kate. You know, rape is it's a really hard crime to get numbers firmly on. And I think as people become more, not comfortable, but are willing to, you know, talk about it, you get probably more accurate numbers as you're moving forward. So it's really hard to tell, you know what I mean? I would think in something like that.
Yeah. And an interesting thing, too, is about 2 years ago, the FDLE changed the definition of rape to include sodomy. So if you look at numbers from even, you can't compare the numbers of 2010 rape charges to today, because you'll see extreme spike. And actually, I've had a lot of people in the newsroom be like, wow, have you seen this spike in rape? And you're like, well, that's kind of... they changed the definition. So
sure.
There would be a spike because they're including more crimes in this category.
Yeah. Long term, I mean, Chuck Rabin, you talked about difficult to read anything into these 6-month snapshots year over year. Kate, you mentioned it as well. But there has been we're going on a 30-year trend of a lower crime rate. You may not know it if you're watching the 11 o'clock news, certainly in Miami. However, the facts of the statistics are indisputable. Is there something that has corresponded in law enforcement? Is it community policing, Chuck Rabin? Is it increase in community training? Is it prosecutorial challenges maybe in the criminal justice system to bring these kinds of cases?
I think there's never a single answer for anything. I think it's a combination of everything. I think the police departments are certainly larger and stronger than they've been. I think people are more observant about what's going on. I think community policing makes a difference. I think people just, deal with their lives in different ways than they did 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was talking to some police departments. They were telling me, what some of the things that they were doing to impact their crime numbers. And I thought it was really interesting when I spoke to Boynton Beach, which had an overall increase in crime.
Right.
They were like,
one of the sharpest overall increases of any of the municipalities
here
in South Florida.
And you look at that and you're like, wow, like that's a big increase. But they were like, well, we expected that increase because we increased our patrol about 25% on the ground. And that's, foot and road patrol. So we are trying to find more crime because we want to get the criminals off the street.
I'll also give you a perfect example. My wife showed me this online site called Nextdoor, I think, which actually it's small. It's just the clusters of little neighborhoods where everybody's talking to each other and dealing with the problems.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the police have latched onto this and they're actually, telling the people in the little neighborhoods where you live, what to look for, or what's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
So things like that make it, it builds on stuff.
Yeah, we've seen obviously Crime Stopper programs with a great deal of publicity and public exposure over the last 2 decades. We've seen more, I know in my neighborhood, occasionally more door-to-door even from a police officer with a pamphlet, text messages that you can sign up, the automatic text messages. So, as this communication happens, Kate, certainly the if you see something, say something mentality, but also boots on the ground, the investment, the public investment that it takes for law enforcement, it sounds like it's paying some dividends.
Oh, yeah. I cover primarily Palm Beach County, so I'm a lot more familiar with our neighbors to the north. But, you look at someone like Delray Beach, and they have a new police chief there, and he's been there for about, I think, a year and a half. And he's been so focused on donuts with a cop, walk and talk programs. And you've seen, if you ask residents there, there's definitely been a change in attitude toward police, crime prevention. I mean, it seems like it's working there.
Miami's been implementing similar things. They have a lot more cops on horsebacks and getting to know your neighborhoods. And
yep.
It makes people feel better.
Back to these 7 police shootings this week, Chuck Rabin, all under internal investigation at this point?
Yeah, they usually take years for these things to be completed. One of the interesting things, that I sort of hit on before was, if you look at them, it's the difference in policies. The last two people who were killed, both apparently suffered mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And there is specific training that most departments have available, but different departments deal with it in a different way, and who's required to take that training. And if you we're trying to look through the numbers now to see how that's affected the different departments.
Oh, we'll look for that in the future. Chuck Rabin covering cops and crime for our partner, the Miami Herald. He's on Twitter at Chuck Rabin. And Kate Jacobson doing much the same for the South Florida Sun Sentinel. She's on Twitter at Kate with a K, Kate Jacobson, S-O-N, just for those Swedish and Norwegian fans out there. We'll clarify that. Thanks to both of you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. We got plenty more to come. Stick with us. A short and sticky story about our slice of paradise. Back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. So we asked, and you delivered in a big, big way, and thank you. For months, as you know, WLRN and the Miami Book Fair International have been collecting short stories about South Florida and beyond but stories with a sticky twist. We've received hundreds of stories on Post-it notes. We call them post-lits. There have been some that are just a few words written in bold type with a Sharpie marker on a very small Post-it. Some have sharpened your pencil very, very, very sharp and crammed in several dozen words, maybe even over 100 words on that same small square page with a sticky strip on the back. You've snapped pictures, you've shared them with us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. You've used our virtual Post-it note that we created on our website, wlrn.org/postlit. Now, some of these will be read Friday night, tonight, at the book fair. We're going to be at the Swamp, 6 o'clock, down at the book fair. One of the last ones that we received came from Elizabeth McGowan, and it really captures the post-lit attitude. She wrote, "Once upon a time, there was a post-it note. All its life, it compared itself to other paper, wondering why it was so small. It thought itself as insignificant, asking itself,
what information could I possibly hold?
One day, the Post-it note was introduced to a wise old pen.
My dear, some of the most important information is withheld among you. You are valuable.
The Post-it note looked up elated. The pen continued.
And to show that size does not equal significance, we're going to write your entire story down on one of your squares.
And so they did. That was the post-lit contributed from Elizabeth McGowan. Lots of folks throughout South Florida got out those wise pens and put them to a pad of Post-its, including this one.
My name is Lee Betsy Prendergast. I'm from Miami, Florida, and this is my post-lit. I'm lost. I am surrounded by the manic sounds of heavy traffic, the smell of cafecito and pan con bistec heavy in the air. I may be lost, but I will not go hungry. For there is a cafeteria followed by a bakery adjacent to a Public Sabor. Signs go from numbers to words. Perhaps I'll make a left turn. Welcome to Hialeah.
There's lots of folks that wrote about how they encountered their communities, and lots of times that was through food. Jessica Patton Pellegrino from Key West sent us this post-lit note about her introduction to life and work in South Florida.
I was introduced to the peace of South Florida at a Publix deli counter. My stepson and I were visiting colleges a year before our family would relocate here from New England. We ordered an Italian sub off the menu. The clerk nodded thoughtfully and embarked to the walk-in cooler. He emerged several moments later with the salami, then returned to the cooler. Out he came with the provolone. Back he went, and so on. One slow-motion foraging mission at a time. I admonished myself for my impatience. Jason's name tag featured a service award, clearly earned with such attention to sandwich-making detail. Ingredients finally laid out, he waved down a coworker. "Can you take over?" he asked. "I'm going on break."
Welcome to South Florida, Jessica. You clearly got out that sharp pencil for that post-it note. Thank you. We also had fourth and fifth graders from the Lenora B. Smith Elementary School in Miami accepting the challenge. They were members of the Radical Readers Book Club, and their sponsor, librarian Samantha Haber, sent us their post-its.
When I went to the Miami Sea Aquarium, I wondered, how did they get the big whale into such a little pool? By Clarissa.
There was a possum in the school. It really looked very cool. It was sitting in a tree, eating berries. By Tyrell.
When I went to the Everglades, I saw an alligator eating a flamingo. Thank you.
At the MLK parade, stilt walkers slipped. Tragic. Thank you.
One day, I saw a man walking his dog in Target in Wynwood. Thank you.
Miami is where we live. By the Radical Readers Book Club from the Nora B. Smith Elementary School.
All right, boys and girls, keep it up. Keep looking for those dogs being walked in Target in Wynwood. You can join us again, WLRN at the Swamp tonight, Friday night at the Miami Book Fair International, 6 o'clock to hear the local storytellers and have a chance to try your hand at the Post-Lit Challenge. The Florida Roundup this week is produced by Julia Duba and Alicia Zuckerman. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our public insight network analyst is Jabeli Herrera. Program director here at WLRN, Peter J. Mayers. And our technical supervisor for the program is Jason Zabka. Thank you, Jay. I'm Tom Hudson. That is the Florida Roundup. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening.